Hare Krishna. So time has been moving along, and we haven't gone very far into the Chaitanya Charitamrita at all. So much more to cover. Obviously, I will not be able to cover everything that I would have liked to, and that was to be expected, because it was a little over ambitious to take on the whole CC in 14 days. But the way I wanted to do it is by taking out some major topics. So I have taken out the principle of Yuga Dharma, right? Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as the avatar for this particular age. And that meant that everything had to be taken into, had to be seen in the context of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Therefore, unless we see devotional service in the context of Lord Chaitanya, it will not be complete. So somehow or other, devotional service in this age has to center around Harinam Sankirtan, around distributing love of God, which were like the principles of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And any type of devotional service that is not really including that spirit, that kind of devotional service will dry up. One of the objectives of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was to unite the four sampradayas. And at one point, he was stating that that was his intention. The reason is because without Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even the other bona fide sampradayas will dry up. We have discussed in the statement of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami that anyone who worships the Supreme Lord but does not accept Lord Chaitanya is a demon, and we have classified that in our understanding it was not that those devotees who are sincerely trying to serve Krishna and are just not so much aware of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are demons, but the ones who are presented with the full philosophy about Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Shastric arguments about him being the Supreme Lord, they would certainly be demons. If one is looking for proof about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, about Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then we can look in the Adi Lila, chapter 2, verse 22. That's very easy to remember, so I'll never forget that myself. Adi 2:22 is where it is proven. There's a whole purport with many verses from various scriptures establishing that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the Supreme Lord. So those who do not worship Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and worship Krishna will dry up if they do not accept Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And in fact, if they receive the full knowledge about Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and still not accept, they'll become demons. Then we discussed the next principle about empowerment and how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as Mali Chaitanya, was growing the fruits of love of God, and then said he could not distribute them all by himself, which obviously was cheating, and because the Lord is unlimited, but he wanted to do it through his devotees. Here we find some intricate meaning of the Panchatattva. The Panchatattva is, Prabhupada translated it, Lord Chaitanya in five features. Right? So that is very interesting that the different tattvas are given there. Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, his immediate expansion. Then Advaita Acharya, the avatar of the Supreme Lord. Then Gadadhar Pandit, the energy of the Supreme Lord. And finally, Srivas Pandit, the jiva, representing Jiva Tattva. So it is very interesting that Jiva Tattva is included in the five features of the Lord. In any other type of approach towards spiritual life that we have encountered in the traditions of the world, we are not having that same understanding that the living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, right? And that he is, that he belongs in that unity with the Supreme Lord in his original position. And otherwise, it is generally, there is two entities, the Lord and the living entity, and the living entity is trying to establish his connection with the Lord. But here, the part of actually being part of the Supreme Lord is essential. So this is very nice, because it really makes the point clear that Lord Chaitanya and the living entity, the Lord and the living entity belong eternally together. And that's very much stressed in this philosophy of Krishna consciousness. It comes out very much in the explanation of the Panchatattva. So that is certainly more emphasized in the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu than anywhere else. We find it in Bhagavad Gita, Mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana, that the living entities are my own parts and parcels. But in Panchatattva, we see how that relationship works very nicely in devotional service. So therefore, in Krishna consciousness, we see that the relationship with the Lord is not some sort of one-way traffic. It is not that the Supreme Lord is kind of an all-pervading, benedicting, loving Lord who is bestowing his love upon all living beings equally, but we are having a personal Lord who is very personally involved with his devotees. Yes, he is that all-benedicting, all-pervading, impartial, loving personality for those who are not surrendered unto him. But for those who are surrendered unto him, the Lord is emotionally involved with his devotee. Sadavo ridhiya mayam sadhanam ridhiyam taham madanyatena janati naham tebya namagapi, which means that Krishna is as much emotionally involved with his devotee as the devotee is with Krishna. And that is like something very special in Krishna consciousness. That the Lord that not only the devotee is subjugated by the Supreme Lord, but that the Lord is also subjugated by his devotee. And that is something that is coming out very much in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And we will, in the next few days, enter a little more in those aspects. So when Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, initially Lord Nityananda cheated him and brought him back to his family members, taking advantage of his ecstatic moods and understanding that Lord Chaitanya wasn't totally aware of the surroundings. Nityananda manipulated him and brought him back to the house of Advaita Acharya. Subsequently, Lord Chaitanya went on the order of his mother to Jagannath Puri and began to also travel and preach, and traveled throughout South India. In Jagannath Puri, before his departure to South India, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in the Jagannath Temple, where he tried to embrace the deities of Lord Jagannath. And he just was about to jump up on the altar and embrace the deities, and somehow or other fainted, and then was brought to the house of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. In due course of time, a whole exchange came about with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And gradually Chaitanya Mahaprabhu defeated all the misconceptions of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. only after he had patiently listened to Mayavad philosophy for 7 days and without any reaction at all. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was wondering, does he understand what I'm talking about? And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was then asked. Sarvabhauma asked him, so do you actually understand the Vedanta Sutra? And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu replied, yes, the Vedanta Sutra I understand very well, but your explanations, I can't make any sense of it. And so he was a little bit offended, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Well, then you explain. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did explain, and explained so expertly. He gave what is called the Mukhya Vritti. There are two types of explanation of scriptures. One is Mukhya Vritti, the other one is Gona Vritti. Mukhya Vritti is the direct dictionary meaning of the words. Whereas if there is no direct dictionary meaning that makes sense of a word, then it is allowed to use Gona Vritti of the Sanskrit and just cut the word up in different syllables and then come to some, derive some meaning from there. But So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya had been following the explanation of Sankaracharya, which had been based upon the interpretation. It was an indirect explanation. And therefore, he was shocked that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was able to give a direct explanation of the Vedanta Sutra without any interpretation but dictionary meaning and establishing the Supreme Lord like that. So by rules of interpretation of Sanskrit, it was a superior explanation. Right? Therefore, it wasn't just another explanation, a very interesting, different explanation, but it was actually superior, because by rules of interpretation, it was superior. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya knew that very well. So that's why, first of all, the explanation was wonderful, but second was that it was based on superior principles of interpretation. So it clearly defeated Sankara, which was shocking and difficult for him to accept. So he had still many more questions, which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then also defeated. And finally, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed him his six-armed form of Sadbhuj. And furthermore, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was heard other explanations. He heard the explanations of the Atmaram verse, which was so many. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu invited Sarvabhauma to give explanations, and he gave 9 interpretations of one verse by giving different meanings of the Sanskrit. But then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu started explaining after that, and first did 60, right? Not touching even upon the ones that Sarvabhauma had already explained. And then one more, right? Just that last one, he said, was brought out by the eagerness of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So in this way, Lord Chaitanya proved to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya that he was the Supreme Lord. And from that moment on, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya became a very surrendered devotee of the Lord. And in the course of that, he quoted one verse, composed one verse. He said, Tarka Shastra Jada Ami Yaicha Loha Pinda. And I like that. He said, by studying the Tarka Shastra, the scriptures of logic dealing with Nyaya, I had become dull. So this seems like such a contradiction, that one becomes dull by logic. Rather, we always think logic makes you sharp, right? So how was he saying that he had become dull by logic, right? The reason why he stated that he had become dull by logic was because by his logic he had become very much attached to particular ideas. And due to his attachment to his preconceived idea, he was prejudiced, and therefore it wasn't possible for him to to hear the absolute truth. Even when it was told to him, he couldn't accept it because he had his logical reasoning and arguments in place. So how they worked like filters and would not allow anything in. Therefore, logic doesn't sharpen the brain, but makes it dull. Which is in certain circles, if we bring this out, if we explain this in universities or something, it is always a good point for starting a debate. If you want to kind of stir it up, then you can tell that that little aspect of the CC. That will get people going. But it is a fact that, therefore, in due course of time, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu met various great personalities. He met the brothers Rupa and Sanatan. We have discussed the first meeting that took place, and we also kind of know what followed after that. That Rupa and Sanatan were engaged in the Muslim government, but they retired. And Rupa Goswami was allowed at retirement and had all his wealth, a boat full of golden coins he was carrying with him as his pension, which he distributed nicely and responsibly. Meanwhile, Sanatan Goswami was still in the government service and refused to work any further, and finally was jailed, right? But escaped from the jail, and we can hear how Prabhupada, in the very early days in 22nd Avenue, was carrying a red book. This red book that he was carrying, no one had ever seen before. But somehow or other, Prabhupada is going to read from this red book. So the devotees are all, what is this red book, right, that he's going to read from today? What is that book? So it was the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And Prabhupada began to read about Sanatan. Now, Prabhupada's Bengali accent made it sound like, to some of the devotees, thought it was Sanatan, Sanatan, Sanatan. So they wrote it down as Sanatan. Others, they made notes and they wrote down Santan, right? So like this, they had different names, Sanatan and Santan, but no one knew for sure that it was who it actually was. And then Sanatan escaped, was in the jail and was trying to escape from the jail, and the tension was just building up. And then Prabhupada said, okay, we'll continue tomorrow. So there's a big discussion, and Hayagriva was saying he especially liked that ending, you know, like to keep the tense suspension going for the next day. He said, just like, you know, reminded him of a TV series or something. So he felt all excited by it. So like this, Prabhupada was taking the devotees to the whole story, how Sanatan escaped from the jail by bribing the jailer, and finally how he went through with his servant Ishana towards the Hazaribagh forest, where an astrologer knew that they had 8 gold coins. It was the servant who had 8 gold coins. Sanatan Goswami didn't have anything. So, but when they came there, the innkeeper was very, very polite to them, although they were poor and didn't have anything. So Sanatan Goswami, since he had been a prime minister, immediately figured out there's something fishy here. It is not right. And therefore asked his servant if he carried any money. And the servant said, yes, I have 7 gold coins. And Sanatan Goswami said, give me those gold coins, right? It's very dangerous. We will be killed for that. And he gave the gold coins to the innkeeper, who said, I knew you had 8 gold coins because an astrologer told me, and I was planning to take you across the forest in the night and then rob you in the night. So it's very good that you have saved me from this sinful activity and given the coins on your own. Therefore, I will take you across the forest and just without any trouble. So then Sanatan went back to his servant and said, so, you still having one more gold coin? He said, yes. Sanatan Goswami said, keep it and go from here and go home. Yeah. So he sent him home. So finally we know that Sanatan Goswami in Benares came to the house of his brother-in-law who gave him a beautiful chadar. And when Sanatan Goswami met Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Mahaprabhu was very happy to see him, but was looking all the time at that chadar. And so Sanatan Goswami could understand, he's not approving of my fancy chadar. And therefore he exchanged that chadar. He went to the river and exchanged it with someone, took an old quilt and gave that very expensive chadar in exchange. So then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very pleased. In due course of time, Sanatan Goswami received the instructions of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu about spiritual life. And that is maybe where I want to arrive. In this, in the paper that we've written, on page number 13, there are the 64 aspects of devotional service listed. I'm not going to read them all, but leave it up to us to read them. I'm sure we have read them, and if not, we can read them. These 64 aspects of devotional service are important because we see that in spiritual life, there is one thing that is important, and that is vows. We're seeing here in these 64 aspects of devotional service, one must accept a bona fide spiritual master, and two, one must accept initiation from him. So taking vows are an essential element in spiritual life. However, we also see that vows are very difficult things. We're seeing that maintaining vows is a major problem. Across the board in our movement, I would say there is not great track record of maintaining vows, right? Whether it's on the top or at the bottom, wherever we look, whether it is with the first disciples of Srila Prabhupada, whether it is with the generation coming after that, whether it is with big devotees, small devotees, so many devotees are, for different reasons, not able to maintain vows, right? Some, at one point in time, don't see the necessity. They don't see the importance anymore. But this, of course, is simply a kind of justification. Right? That is, if we want to really give up something, we have to find reasons for it. So then you can come up with some sort of reason that, well, when I took that vow, I was a different person. I was so many years younger. I was at a different phase of my development. Now I've gone through so much. In fact, you know, almost in the mood of Deinu Sminyata De, hey, I've given up that former identity. Now I have become a new person. I've given up that old subtle body. Now I have a new subtle body, a new mood. Therefore, I can't identify anymore with the old vow. And therefore, I don't feel that it's relevant to me today. Such kind of justifications have deeper roots. Such kind of justifications come only after we've been neglectful. Yeah. So to think that it is possible to simply accept out of these 64 aspects of devotional service, number one and two, right, or maybe three as well, one must accept a bona fide spiritual master, one must accept initiation from him, number two and three, one must serve him, all right, four, one must receive instructions, that's already going pretty far. Then you already get very serious. So for many, it stopped then at 1 and 2. Right? After the initiation, it stopped. And that's where the problems came in. Unless we take shelter of these 64 different aspects of devotional service, we will not be able to maintain the vows. These I would call them the building stones of our spiritual life. We ourselves are building our own spiritual life by filling our time, our whole day, with these 64 activities. And if we do that, if we center our life around these as much as we can, then everything becomes very, very nice and auspicious. So it doesn't matter where one is, whether one lives far from a temple. If one in his house introduces these 64 different types of devotional service, then that house becomes the spiritual world. One can keep Tulsi, right? I mean, there's no reason why one wouldn't be able to keep Tulsi. So, if we see how many people buy plants, right? It's inconceivable how many plants are being bought by people and how many hours people that are totally entangled in material life spend in watering and caring for plants, right? So why not care for Tulasi Devi, right? So every householder could keep Tulasi Devi. Well, we see that Haridas Thakur kind of simplified these 64 aspects of devotional service to the most important one, chanting Hare Krishna, but in front of the Tulasi plant. So, if one can simply grow Tulasi at home and serve Tulasi very nicely and keep very nicely and chant in front of Tulasi, that's very much recommended. Yeah. Prabhupada speaks about worshipping the deity at home, all those things. Right? So, whether in the temple or whether at home, these 64 items are very, very important. And they give us the power to maintain the vows. This is simply the key to maintaining vows, is by preoccupying ourselves with these 64 activities. So, as I'm staying on this theme today of maintaining vows, I want to go on. I don't want to stay with this particular point. I want to go on to Rupa Goswami. So, not only did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instruct Sanatana Goswami, but he also separately instructed Rupa Goswami in Prayag. The instructions he gave to Rupa Goswami are basically the same instructions as he gave to Sanatana Goswami. Therefore, we also find that the teachings that are given here in these 64 principles that were taught to Sanatana Goswami, we find that Rupa Goswami describes the very same principles in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, in the Nectar of Devotion. And in the Nectar of Devotion, the first 14 chapters are elaborating on these 64 principles. So if we want to kind of read more about it, then more detail, then the first 14 chapters of Nectar of Devotion deal with that. But in the chapter where the teachings to Rupa Goswami are described, there is a nice section dealing with the Bhakti Lata Beach, which is one of the very important points in our philosophy, and really stands out. So I want to read a little bit from that. Let me see. Yes, we start with Brahmanda Brahmite Kuna Bhagyavana Jeev. Guru Krishna Prasadapaya Bhakti Lata Beach. According to their karma, all living entities are wandering throughout the entire universe. Some of them are being elevated to the upper planetary systems, and some are going down into the lower planetary systems. Out of many millions of wandering living entities, one who is very fortunate gets an opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master by the grace of Krishna. By the mercy of both Krishna and the spiritual master, such a person receives the seat of the creeper of devotional service. When a person receives the seed of devotional service, he should take care of it by becoming a gardener and sowing the seed in his heart. If he waters the seed gradually by the process of Sravan and Kirtan, hearing and chanting, the seed will begin to sprout. As one waters the Bhakti Lata beads, the seed sprouts and the creeper gradually increases to the point where it penetrates the walls of this universe and goes beyond the Viroja river between the spiritual world and the material world. It attains Brahmaloka. That Brahmaloka referred to here is not the planet of Lord Brahma, but is the Brahmajyoti. Right? The Brahman effulgence, and penetrating through that stratum, it reaches the spiritual sky and the spiritual planet Golok Vrindavan. Being situated in one's heart and being watered by Shravana Kirtan, the Bhakti creeper grows more and more. In this way, it attains the shelter of the desire tree of the lotus feet of Krishna, who is eternally situated in the planet known as Goloka. The creeper greatly expands in the Goloka Vrindavan planet, and there it produces the fruit of love for Krishna. Although remaining in the material world, the gardener regularly sprinkles the creeper with the water of hearing and chanting. If the devotee commits an offense at the feet of a Vaishnava while cultivating the creeper of devotional service in the material world, his offense is compared to a mad elephant that uproots the creeper and breaks it. In this way, the leaves of the creeper are dried up. The gardener must defend the creeper by fencing it all around so that the powerful elephant of offenses may not enter. Sometimes unwanted creepers, such as the creepers of desire for material enjoyment and liberation from the material world, grow along with the creeper of devotional service. The varieties of such unwanted creepers are unlimited. So Prabhupada is pointing out that one is not only having a bhakti lata beach, but also karma lata beach, jnana lata beach, and that one can grow, put in the seeds of karma in his heart, the seeds of fruit of desire, or the seeds of trying for liberation from material existence, but by merging into the supreme and becoming one with the Lord. Now, if one does not distinguish between the Bhakti Lata creeper and the other creepers, the sprinkling of water is misused because the other creepers are nourished while the Bhakti Lata creeper is curtailed. Purport. If one chants the Hare Krishna mantra while committing offenses, these unwanted creepers will grow. So this is an important point. That now we see how the unwanted creepers can grow by committing offenses while chanting the holy name. So that's a very important thing, that these creepers are indeed growing. And this whole seed principle is very important. That not only are there bhakti seeds, but there are jnana seeds and there are karma seeds. Right? Which means that we may think that, well, I can read some books. I know there's a little Mayavadi in them, but anyway, I just read over that. You know, if ever I read a page like that, I just disregard it, but I just take out the good thing. Right? I just have my filters on. And I have good filters because I've read Prabhupada's books very carefully. Therefore, I have the filters of Prabhupada's books, and I just read through these other books, filtering them, and you know, if I find something impersonal, I just throw it out, right? Like that. Yes, that's all very nice. It is certainly a fact that to that such filters are valuable. But what about the seed principle? The seed enters into our heart and will fructify later. That is the point. It will work on its own. So therefore, it is said that Maya Vadya Basya Sunile Hoya Sarvanasya, that if we are associating with the Mayavad philosophy, everything will be spoiled. Although at this very moment, we may think, well, it doesn't do anything to me. You know, I'm not at all affected by it. You know, I think it's totally dry and uninteresting, and I'm certainly not open to it. Yes, but it plants the seed in the heart. The same with enjoyment. Long before I joined Krishna Consciousness, I once read a book about Gandhi and his movement. And there was a story about one of his secretaries. So in Gandhi's movement, they were celibate. Right? They were celibate, and this secretary had been celibate for something like 20 years or more, whatever, you know. Very, very long time, 20, 30 years. So many years, he had, and although he was married, so his wife and him had lived all these years separately, and then some political enemies, they tried to break Gandhi's movement. So they were deciding to infiltrate the movement, and therefore they got this prostitute, and they sent her over to work in the office of this man, you know, like... And she came in the office and she had all different poses and etc. to bewilder his mind. Right? So it had an effect. Right? Not that, not what the opponents had wanted. The opponents had wanted that he would fall down with that prostitute. But that didn't happen. That didn't happen. But that night, he walked across the corridor to the room of his wife, where he hadn't been for 20 years or more, right? Because this association with that other lady had brought out the desire, which started to work in his heart and gradually wore down his determination. Now, so it impressed me that when I read that story in those days, it impressed me because I was thinking, yes, this is a more subtle way of how one becomes influenced. And we notice this in our own spiritual life also. How the different times we get bombarded by lusty scenes and lusty things we see or hear, or that it kind of continues to work internally and then comes out in a different way by which we suddenly become agitated ourselves. Independent of that situation that initially brought kind of fueled the lust. So this is an example of clearly how the seed can work. And sometimes, now there may be quick sprouting seeds and slow sprouting seeds. The seeds of material enjoyment may take a long time to sprout. The seeds of impersonalism may take a long time to sprout. So therefore we should be careful in associating with Mayavat, or in associating with, it says, Jositam Sangisangam, that one should not associate with those who are attached to illicit sex. Be very careful with that. That will certainly water and plant more seeds in our heart that then with time will be fructifying and cause us trouble. So in the process of devotional service, though, it said, anaktapasamam saksat bhakti yoga madokshaje, that devotional service can destroy the seeds from the heart. All these material anartas and contaminations will be destroyed by the heart, by the process of devotional service. But it is explained that in the course of devotional service, there are two types of offenses. One is nama aparad, the other one is seva aparad. They are included in the 64 aspects of devotional service. So, because these 64 aspects of devotional service include both positive activity and prohibitions. Now, there are 32 offenses that can be made in the cause of serving, seva aparat, in cause of serving the deity. It said that if one commits seva aparat, then one, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains, then one will get reactions in the cause of his service. So as we are engaging in service, we'll get suffering during our devotional service for the seva aparat. But it will not contaminate the heart with nu anartas. But nam aparat actually contaminates the heart and creates nu anartas within the heart. Now if we purposely, if we consciously commit seva aparat, let's say, bowing down again, I just did it. You know, you're just in the temple, you go out for 1 minute, right? And you come back in, well, you know, and you just fold two hands. No, then it is a seva aparat, because one is meant to, then it's not seva aparat, then it becomes nam aparat, because one consciously is ignoring the prescribed rule. But if one somehow or other forgets certain details, right, in the course of service, and not purposely but accidentally breaks these rules of prescribed behavior in front of the deity, then it is seva aparat, and reactions come in the course of one's service, but they don't contaminate the heart. But contamination of the heart, as we can see, is planting seeds in our heart, and these seeds are fructifying again in big creepers. So these seeds are there, and later on, again, other similar opportunities come, and we find that we have become less and less, that we become less serious and less careful. So this is very, very dangerous. So in this chapter to Rupa Goswami, there is a great warning about offenses, about committing offenses. And that is indeed a very important element. We find in different scriptures, Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita, we find many warnings against committing offenses. There are several pastimes where offenses are being committed. Ramachandra Puri, who's offending his spiritual master, or Amoga, who is offending Chaitanya Mahaprabhu by criticizing his eating, and also later offense. Then Ramachandra Khan is there. So there are different kinds of personalities described who are committing offenses. And we see that that's a very serious matter. Each of them are becoming highly, highly, they suffer a lot. And if we find the time, then in the next few days, then I should maybe spend one session on these offenses, because they're so important. So many times we may find that while we are struggling in spiritual life to maintain our vows, right, that lusty desires are plaguing us, and that somehow or other it causes a great dilemma, and that sometimes a slip on the path may happen. Then what to do? We can understand that we should see how we have been committing nam aparat, right, in our devotional service. That we should see. We should, if there is a difficulty in maintaining the vows, then one should not just write it off with a kind of mood from, well, what can I do? This is the way I am, right? You know, I am just not so advanced yet. I'm trying. I'll try again. You know, I'm not giving up. No. I'm not giving up. But okay, a slip was there. What can I do? I'm just not a pure devotee. You know, I'm trying. No, that's not enough to kind of say, well, this is the way I am. No, one should understand that the reason why we fell prey to material desires is because we made offenses against the holy name. We should understand that when it comes to committing the offenses against the holy name, that it's not that something that sometimes may happen, well, you know, like we're chanting and all that, and then, well, in the course of that, we may be a little careless and some offense is made or something, or some anartha comes out and an offense is made. No, rather, we should think that our normal condition of life at present is offensive. Right? We are like a big boil. You know, we are like we're offense personified. That was our normal condition. Right? From our material life, by nature, we were totally offensive, and then gradually, by association with devotees and the process of devotional service, we begin to become aware of it, how offensive we actually were and are. And then we come gradually to the point of rectifying it. So in this way, it's not that, oh well, generally we're doing very nice and only suddenly sometimes there is this offense. No, there is some basic offensiveness in our mood, right? Like to blaspheme the devotees, right? That is like deeply rooted in our whole, it's practically our second nature to kind of, not to just go around and calling everyone's name, but it begins, the root is in the mind, right? It's like already there on the mental plane, we are thinking, well, this guy, that guy, this person, that person, and the tendency to be critical and find fault is kind of natural at first. Therefore, some rectification is needed. So the principal rectification to avoid this offensive mentality that we come from our conditioning, is in the Trinadapi Sunichena instruction. Right? That Trinadapi Sunichena instruction, which is like practically the central instruction for conquering these offensive tendencies. To be more humble than a blade of grass, to be more tolerant than a tree, and to offer all respects to others. These are the three principles in that verse, right? So the tolerance, the humility, and to offer respect to others. So these three elements are essential elements of humility. So much is made out of humility. And if we look in Sada Char, then we see this humility. In my paper, I had also some points here on humility. On page 11, Sanatan Goswami was so humble, he walked over the hot beats and burned his feet because he didn't want to touch the pujaris, considering himself so fallen. Haridas Thakur, all the devotees came from Bengal, and they came to meet Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was staying near the Jagannath temple in the house of Kasi Misra. After thus offering respect to each and every devotee, Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became very jubilant. However, not seeing Haridas Thakur, he inquired, "Where is Haridas?" Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then saw in the distance that Haridas was lying down flat on the road offering obeisances. Haridas did not come to the Lord's meeting place, but remained fallen flat on the common road at a distance. So all the devotees were there, and they were all meeting Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was greeting everyone, and so happy to see, oh, Advaita Acharya, oh, he was Shivananda Sen, and he was inquiring how they were. And then after some time, he said, where's Haridas? And Haridas was lying in the road. Because Haridas said, I'm too fallen, I cannot come near the temple, I have no authority. Even although Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally invited him, Haridas was thinking, no, I am fallen, I have no authority. So he was considering himself very fallen. And then we have the famous Krishnadas Kaviraj statements. I am more sinful than Jagai and Madai, and even lower than the worms in the stool. Anyone who hears my name loses the result of his pious activities. Anyone who utters my name becomes sinful. So how can a devotee walk around like this? Once we were discussing this, and then one devotee was saying, you know, when I read this stuff, I become depressed, you know. I mean, I feel totally, if I try to get in this mood, if I imitate this mood, if I try to meditate like that, he said, I begin to get more and more depressed. I get an inferiority complex. I feel totally useless, you know, like, and I just think, I am useless, you know, I can't do anything, I have no qualification, I may as well jump off a bridge kind of mood, right? So he said, I can't understand how the acharyas can just go around and just, you know, calling themselves lower than a worm in stool, right? I mean, isn't there anything like self-respect, self-esteem in Krishna consciousness? Can't we just, you know, have a little bit of that? Right? Well, after these two verses from Krishnadas Kaviraj, being lower than the worm in stool and everyone loses his pious activities by utterance of my name, there is the third verse. Who in this world but Nityananda could show his mercy to such an abominable person as me? So generally you hear the first two verses, but not the third one. But you have to hear them all three together, otherwise it doesn't make the picture complete. Otherwise, indeed, it would be depressing, right, to say, I'm lower than a worm in stool. And if you say it every day, I'm lower than a worm in stool, worm that I am, lower than a worm in stool. And if you say that the whole day, after a while, you begin to feel like, you know, and you might be ready for a psychiatrist and for a therapy, right? And saying like, I've repressed my nature for all these years in this Krishna consciousness movement, right? And I feel like totally, you know, that I was suppressing my real identity and all that. But if we realize that, yes, I'm low, but I have received the mercy of Lord Nityananda, then we understand better. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written this song, Kalyana Kalpataru. And in that song, Kalyana Kalpataru, he is the auspicious desire tree. It says, my spiritual master gave me an auspicious desire tree. But I was not able to really take care of it nicely because I have a very harsh mind. And therefore, I covered the power of this desire tree. But the association of the devotees restores the full power of this desire tree. Right? Still, although I covered it a little bit with my harsh mind, the power of this tree is so great, even my harsh mind couldn't cover it. And therefore, although it's now not available in its full glories, still, whatever remnants are there, even that is wonderful. And therefore, although I have a harsh mind and no qualification, I have at the same time a wonderful gift from my spiritual master, and therefore I have something to give. So in this way, one can be most fallen and at the same time have something to give. We got the process of devotional service. That is the desire tree. We have the holy name. That we have. And therefore, although we are most fallen, we have at the same time the most wonderful thing to give. And therefore, it's not at all depressing to be the most fallen when you have the most wonderful thing to give. So, in that way, a devotee can meditate on being the most fallen. Then, I did just a little exercise for myself. writing down the benefits of humility. And I try to kind of make a little list. It's my own list. And then I also looked a little bit in Prabhupada's books about some points. But most of the list I was just thinking what the benefits would be from. So it's sort of a meditation. So for whatever it's worth. Benefits of humility. One, that we become open to superior persons. And in that way we can receive mercy. That's one benefit. Two, when we are humble, then we become wary of committing offenses. We become more careful. We start to think that we are not great. So it protects us from offenses. When one is humble, one is open to learn. Yeah. Just like that example of the of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who was so proud of his logic, he couldn't learn. But after he gave up the pride, then he could learn. When one is humble, one can act as a servant. And when we act as a servant, the service generates mercy in a superior. See, if we serve someone very nicely, then after some time, that person begins to feel indebted to us. So in this way, a superior becomes indebted. And therefore, that superior person begins to share things. Therefore, humility is very important when we serve someone. And when we start to, out of humility, serve superiors, they will bestow mercy upon us because they will feel indebted. In the same way, it works with the Lord. The Lord also feels indebted by our service. So in this way, one can generate kripa. It is said there are three types, three siddhas, Nitya Siddha, Sadhana Siddha, and Kripa Siddha. So Kripa Siddha is where you get the mercy, either from the Lord or the pure devotee. And it's how to get it? By service.
Okay.
Then the next point is, an advantage of humility is that one can accept his faults and then work on rectifying them. Right? Because one is open to look at his own faults when there's humility. So when it's pride, how can one accept his own faults? Then one cannot work on them. Our next point is that it will protect one from enjoying the side benefits of devotional service. Like the side benefits of devotional service are honor, respect, facilities. Right? The more service we do, the more facility we get, the more recognition we get. And then we can enjoy this. This is called Tarangaranjini. Tarangaranjini is enjoying the side benefits of devotional service, and it spoils our chance to get Krishna. And so if one is humble, then one is not considering, I'm not worthy of these benefits. And even if I'm receiving some, I'm simply receiving them not because of my qualifications. Just like people are saying so many times, when you're sannyasi, everyone's bowing down. Isn't that very difficult? Yes, it is one aspect of, one must be careful for that. But one can remember, they're not bowing down to me, they're bowing down to the danda. Because if tomorrow I would be in white cloth, they wouldn't bow down to me at all, right? They're bowing down to the cloth. It's not that they're bowing down to me, right? So that's one thing I remember. If I would like put off this cloth, right? No one would bow down to me anymore. Right? That's for sure. So it's the cloth they're bowing down to, not to me. This isn't not to the sannyasi. This is an important meditation. But maybe even more difficult than bowing down to the danda is admiration, constant admiration. It was wonderful what you said. It was wonderful what you did. It was brilliant. It was so inspiring. I mean, I thank you so much. I feel completely rejuvenated again, you know? Like, I mean, now there's a real opportunity to think like, wow, you know, I'm God's gift on earth. I'm a direct via media of the Supreme Lord. I'm like mercy personified, and one can begin to enjoy, and this is very dangerous. So one must understand that no, it's not me. It's that Kalyana Kalpataru. It's that auspicious desire tree. I have covered it by my harsh mind, and therefore I wasn't able to present it in its full glories. But in spite of that, still some glory came through, and that's why people felt enlivened by some words, even of a wretch, coming from the mouths of a wretch like myself, right, who is thoroughly corrupt with material desires, right, and envy, and so many other bad qualities. So in this way, humility can save one from enjoying the side benefits of devotional service. It's a very important point. In this regard, I'm remembering one famous photo of Prabhupada in Gujarat when they offered him a silver throne, and he's sitting on this silver throne, and he has this kind of very, very, his hands are folded, his head is tilted to one side, his eyes are closed, and he looks downwards a little bit. And that downwards look, right, is a look like, kind of like, forgive me for sitting on this throne, right? That's kind of, at least what I read out of it, kind of a look of humility from, I'm only sitting on this thing, you know, because I'm the representative of the Sampradaya of the Supreme Lord. I mean, I know I shouldn't be sitting on such a thing, but what can I do? It's my duty. I must do it. That kind of a look on his face, it is like very, very inspiring. I don't know if you know the photo I'm talking about. Some of you may be able to visualize it. But it's like very, very humble. Very, very humble expression. A silver throne and Prabhupada sitting like that. Humility also conquers the hearts of all people, right? We see that in the six Goswamis, in the famous verse, Dira, Dira, Priya, Jana, Karo. We also see it in Jayananda, right, who was like so humble, he was ready to do any service. The famous story how Jayananda, when he was the temple president, was still taking out the garbage, and when he met a man out there in the street. And he spoke with this man while taking out the garbage, and the man was very, very impressed. And from that day on, after that he went to the temple, and the man said, yes, I was thinking that if the man who takes out the garbage is like this, then what will the others be like? That's a famous story. The Jayananda was like that. Very nice. Very, very humble. And in this way conquered everyone by his humility. So, another benefit of humility is that one can become the instrument of the Lord. One becomes the instrument of the Lord. And let him guide. Right? The Lord is guiding us from within. He gives us signs. And like Prabhupada had a car accident in Kenya, I think it was. Or Mauritius it was. Mauritius. You're from Mauritius? Yes. Car accident was in Mauritius. So, and after he had that accident, then Prabhupada was sitting in his room and Harikesh was reading from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Prabhupada had some bandages and some yellow medicine, and he was saying that this is too risky, going here and there for preaching and going in these cars, and I could have died, and it's not worth it just going to meet some person just because someone asked, right? Maybe I should stay in India and just translate the books, it's more important, and like that, right? He was talking, and he was saying, maybe it's a sign from Krishna. Maybe it's a sign from Krishna. So it's like that we, that the devotee is looking for signs from Krishna, right? So, but one must be humble. Otherwise, how can one kind of look for the signs from Krishna, what Krishna wants? One must try to let himself be guided. Another interesting aspect of humility, I was thinking, is that because one doesn't consider his own ideas and his own needs very important, one becomes detached. So humility leads to detachment, because we don't think, I'm very important. So if you think I'm important, then I need an important room. I need an important bed to take care of this important body and important clothes. And whatever I eat is very important. In fact, I think that some of the big leaders in our society who got into trouble over this, because everything became so important. I mean, even if it is like the king, you know, the king cut the royal finger. The royal finger has been cut. The finger of the king. The whole kingdom is talking about the royal finger. No, the royal finger has been cut. Right? So it is like, when one is king, then everything is important. Every thought, every little thing is important. So in this way, I think some of our greater leaders, they started to think that everything, every little thought they had, every little sniff they made, every glance was important. And therefore, they became attached. They became attached to the royal back. They became attached to the lotus feet and needed special lotus shoes to take care of lotus feet, right? Such soft lotus feet, etc. And until they set their lotus backside on a lotus chair and finally could not see anymore that so much, that some impurities were all there. In their minds, no. They were thinking, only lotus minds. So how could there be anything in my pure lotus mind? Right. So therefore, humility makes us detached. Pride makes us attached. One thing I was thinking, another thing is, again in the mood of Jayananda, when one is humble, then he can give opportunities to others and in this way encourage them. So that is another good quality coming out of humility. In humility, one can also go beyond the limits of Varnashram, where we want to go for our my nature. But if you're humble and think, well, my nature is not very important because I'm not important. I'm just a simple, humble servant. I'll do anything and anything. I mean, whatever they tell me, I'm not important. Yeah. So one sees immediately, you go immediately beyond this, like, my propensity, my nature, my varna, my thing. Immediately go beyond. So humility is the key to go beyond Varna Ashram. Another point I was thinking about it is it can bring out honesty, humility in us. Right? When there's humility, then one can look at himself as he is, rather than having a idea, a concept, and living for one's image and forgetting one's real identity. So humility is necessary for honesty. Okay. So humility and honesty are close. Humility makes us dependent on the Supreme Lord. We realize how dependent we are, which is very important, because that's reality. We are totally dependent. We can't do anything without the sanction of the Lord. We are totally dependent. So this is another very important point. So again, humility, one can give up the tendency to control. Prabhupada said we can become relieved from the false pride of family lineage. Prabhupada said, entire bhakti depends on one's service attitude. And I was thinking that Krishna has arranged the entire material world. If we think of Deinu Sminyata Dehe, changing different bodies, different phases of life, he's just simply arranged it to make us humble. Because growing old makes you humble. Right? You lose everything, you know. I mean, I had a kind of humbling experience myself. A few years ago, I was in South Africa, and someone said, you have to come to the ocean and swim in the ocean. And I never go, you know, to these things, but somehow or other, this person convinced me to go. So I went, and they have these lifeguards, you know, at the side of the beach, and they sit there on their high stools, and they have a speaker, you know. So I was with my gamsha, you know, because I didn't even have swimming pants, I had a gamsha. So I was going with my gamsha into the ocean, and then suddenly this loudspeaker, this voice comes out really loud and says, this skinny guy in the funny red skirt, you know, are you sure you can swim? Right? Now, I always used to think of myself like a real good swimmer. I used to be, you know. I mean, I could swim like 7 kilometers, you know, when I was like 15 or so. At a stretch, 7 kilometers I could swim, right? So I used to think, you know, I'm from Holland, you know, water everywhere. Swimming was my thing, you know. I could swim like anything. So at first, my first reaction was like, I was offended, you know. I was offended. But then I was thinking, well, maybe he's right. Maybe I lost it. Right? Maybe I am not such a good swimmer anymore. And suddenly I realized that everybody can see it except me. Right? So the aging process does that. It takes everything away. All our powers, everything, we lose it. We lose our wit, we lose our everything, our beauty, our strength, everything. We lose it. So it's kind of very humbling to lose everything. And little by little, you lose a few teeth, you lose a knee, you know, you lose things, right? In the end, you know, we've lost so much. You lose half your stomach, you lose half your brain, right? By the time, at the end, there's like Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami said, it's a miracle. It's a miracle that I'm writing this Chaitanya Charitamrita. I'm blind. I practically can't see. My brain is finished. I have no memory left. My body is plagued by all kinds of diseases all the time. Right? All the time. My hands are shaking. How am I writing? It's inconceivable. Only by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. All right. Anyway, these were some ideas I had on humility, and for me it was nice to jot these things down because it kind of was a little meditation on the value of humility. And if some of you want to add something to that, then please go ahead. Or if there's, well, I used up too much time. Not much questions today. I try to really move on, see, today. I try to just plow right through so that we can go into another part. Otherwise, I had a feeling we were going to get stuck. So that's why I kind of quickly passed over a lot of subject matter today. I hope you don't mind. But then it opens up new ways tomorrow, because we were kind of in crossways. Tomorrow you'll see how will lead into the next part, like create a little suspense, be more okay. But if there's any one question or comment, I'll answer it shortly. Yeah, I understand. I have an analogy for that. It's a very simple one. It's like some years ago, I had some medical tests done in a hospital in Calcutta, blood tests, stool tests, urine tests and all that, right, in a laboratory. And when it came back, I looked at the list of the results and everything was there. And then in the stool test, it said smell, right? It said smell on it, you know. And I don't know, I forgot what it said, stinks, I guess. But so then I visualized this, you know, I got this vision of the people in the laboratory all day, having to smell stool, right? I just think this is amazing. So if we want to use all those things, right, study all those things in Krishna consciousness, then it's something like that, you know, like studying philosophies and studying all these things. It's like stool tests and different, or laboratory work. Now, you hear of people who are doing laboratory work, researching different diseases to learn from them so that we can cure the diseases, right? That there is a danger that sometimes they catch the disease in the laboratory. So that element is there. Therefore, Jiva Goswami mentions in the Sandarbhas that we don't need to bother with this. We don't need to bother with this. Jiva Goswami said, Prabhupada did sanction that we could study other philosophies for the sake of understanding their conclusions and their arguments so that we could defeat it. But again, we have to be careful. We may become contaminated. Yeah. We see, though, that Baladev Vijayabhusana is doing a point-for-point refutation of Saririyaka Bhashya, right? So it can be done, but one must be really sure that he's immune, right, and doesn't become contaminated. Because if you start reading management books, right, too much, then Seven Habits or other habits, you might, you should understand, the seeds that go in are seeds of faith. So one begins to divide his faith. Not only like Bhagavad Gita is the answer to everything, but also the management book is, or also Reiki is, or also astrology is, or also so many other things are. So they cause like they could cause a conflict of faith. You see, that is the problem. So that is the risk. That is the possible disease one could catch. But if one is very careful and one has sufficient immunity, then there's a chance that one won't catch the disease, certainly. But we must do this with care. Therefore, again, balanced. We can't spend too much time with that, you know, all day long just involved with that. No, the bulk of our time should be with the main hardcore philosophy. And then a little bit of the other stuff, like chutney on the side, remember? I said the main four books, Bhagavad Gita. In the 64 aspects of devotional service, there's a purport about reading these four books, Bhagavad Gita, Nectar of Devotion, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Prabhupada said, that's all we need to read. That's the main thing. So that's the rice, dal, sabji, chapati, the rest, chutney only. Yes. I'm going over time, and it's Tatvavit's class is on now. So we please write your question down, and then we'll deal with it. Sorry for taking too much time in the presentation. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.